Twentyman Jones wore a huge service pistol holstered on his skinny hip. Behind him was little Mr. Brantingham, the mine bookkeeper, his head bald as an ostrich egg and much too large for his narrow, rounded shoulders. Behind his gold-rimmed pince-nez, he was close to tears, but he carried a double-barreled shotgun in his pudgy white hands. "You are a brave man," Santaine told him. "I won't forget your loyalty." She led Twentyman Jones into her office and sat down thankfully at her desk. "How many other men are with us?" she asked. "Only the office staff," he said. "8 of them. The artisans and mine staff are all out, though I suspect there has been pressure on some of them." "Even Rogers and McClure?" They were her senior overseers. "Are they out also?" "I'm afraid so. Both of them are on the strike committee." "With Forey?" "The 3 of them are the ringleaders," said Twentyman Jones. "I'll see that they never work again," she said bitterly. And he dropped his eyes and mumbled, "I think we have to bear in mind that they haven't broken the law. They have the legal right to withhold their labour and to bargain collectively." "Not when I am struggling to keep the mine running," said Santaine. "Not when I am trying to ensure that there will be jobs for at least some of them. Not after all I've done for them." "I'm afraid they do have that right," he insisted. "Whose side are you on, Dr. Twentyman Jones?" He looked stricken. "You should never have to ask that question," he said. "From the first day we met, I've been your man. You know that. I was merely pointing out your legal position." Immediately contrite, Santaine stood up and reached for his arm to console him. "Forgive me. I'm tired and jumpy," she said. She had stood up too quickly, and the blood drained from her head. She turned deathly pale and swayed giddily on her feet. He seized her and steadied her. "When did you last sleep? You had driven from Windhoek without rest." He led her to the leather sofa and forced her gently down upon it. "You are going to sleep now for at least 8 hours. I'll have fresh clothes brought down from your bungalow." "I must speak to the leaders," she said. "No." He shook his head as he drew the curtains. "Not until you are refreshed and strong again. Otherwise, you could make mistakes of judgment." She sagged back and pressed her fingers into her closed eyelids. "You are right, as always," she said. "I'll wake you at 6 this evening, and I'll inform the strike committee that you will interview them at 8. That will give us 2 hours to plan our strategy." The 3 members of the strike committee filed into Santaine's office, and she stared at them for fully 3 minutes without speaking. She had deliberately had all the chairs removed, except those in which she and Twentyman Jones sat. The strikers were forced to stand before her like schoolboys. "There are over 100,000 men out of work in this country at the present time," she said in a dispassionate voice, "any one of whom would go down on his knees for your jobs." "That won't bloody work," said McClure. He was a nondescript-looking man of medium height and uncertain age, but Santaine knew he was quick-witted, tenacious and resourceful. She wished he was with her rather than against. "If you are going to use foul language in front of me, Mr. McClure," she said, "you can leave immediately." "That won't work either, Mrs. Courtney." He smiled sadly in acknowledgement of her spirit. "You know our rights, and we know our rights." Santaine looked at Rogers. "How is your wife, Mr. Rogers?" A year previously, She had paid for the woman to travel to Johannesburg for urgent treatment by one of the leading abdominal surgeons in the Union. Rogers had gone with her on full pay and all expenses paid. "She's well, Mrs. Courtney," he said sheepishly. "And what does she think of this nonsense of yours?" He looked down at his feet. "She's a sensible lady," Santayne went on. "I would think she is worrying about her three little ones." "We are all together," Fury cut in. "We are all solid, and the women are behind us. You can forget all that. Mr. Fury, please do not interrupt me when I am speaking. Playing the high and mighty Lady Muckamuck around here is going to get you nowhere," he blustered. "We've got you and your bloody mine and your bloody diamonds over a barrel. You are the one who's got to do the listening when we speak, and that's the plain fact of the matter." He grinned cockily and looked to his mates for approbation. The grin concealed his trepidation. On one side, he had Lothar de la Rey and his threat. If he could not come up with a good enough excuse for not performing his obligations, he knew he was a dead man. He had to aggravate the strike until someone else transported the diamonds and gave him an escape. "You aren't going to get one single bloody diamond off this property until we say so, lady. We're keeping them here as hostages. We know you've got a really whopping packet sitting there in the strong room, and that's where it will stay until you listen to what we have to say." He was a good enough judge of character to guess what Santayne Courtney's reaction to that threat would be. Santayne studied his face intently. There was something that did not ring true, something devious and convoluted in his manner. He was being too deliberately aggressive and provocative. "All right," she agreed quietly. "I'll listen. Tell me what you want." She sat quietly while Fury read the list of demands. Her face was impassive. The only signs of her anger that Twentyman Jones knew so well were the soft flush of blood that stained her throat and the steady rhythmic tap of her foot on the wooden floor. Fury reached the end of the reading, and there was another long silence. Then he proffered the document. "This is your copy," he said. "Put it on my desk," she ordered, disdaining to touch it. "The people that were retrenched from this mine last month were given 3 months' pay in lieu of notice," she said. "Three times more than they were entitled to. You know that. They were all given good letters of reference. You know that also." "They are our mates," Fury said stubbornly. "Some of them are family." "All right," she nodded. "You have made your position clear. You may leave now." She rose, and they looked at one another in consternation. "Aren't you going to give us an answer?" McClure asked. "Eventually," she nodded. "When will that be?" "When I am ready, and not before." They filed towards the door, but before he reached it, McClure turned back and faced her defiantly. "They've closed the company store and cut off the water and electricity to our cottages," he challenged her. "On my orders," she agreed. "You can't do that." "I don't see why not," she said. "I own the store, the generator, the pump house, and the cottages." "We've got wives and children to feed." "You should have thought about them before you started your strike," she said. "We can take what we want, you know. Even your diamonds. You can't stop us." "Make me a very happy woman," she invited. "Do it. Break into the store and steal the goods from the shelves. Dynamite the strong room and take my diamonds. assault my loyal people. Nothing would please me more than to see the three of you in jail for life or dancing on the gallows tree." As soon as they were alone again, she turned to Twentyman Jones. "He is right," she said. "The first and only consideration is the diamonds. I have to get them safely into the bank vaults in Windhoek." "We can send them in under police escort," he agreed, but she shook her head. "It might take 5 more days for the police to reach her. There is all sorts of red tape before they can move. No, I want those diamonds away from here before dawn. You know the insurance doesn't cover riot and civil disturbance. If something happens to them, I will be ruined, Dr. Twentyman Jones. They are my lifeblood. I cannot risk them falling into the hands of these ignorant, arrogant brutes." "Tell me what you intend," he said. "I want you to take the Daimler round to its garage in the rear. Have it refueled and checked. We will load the diamonds through the back door." She pointed across her office to the concealed door she used sometimes when she wished to avoid being seen entering or leaving. "At midnight, when the pickets are asleep, you will cut the barbed wire fence directly opposite the garage door." "Good." He was following her intentions. "That will let us out into the sanitary lane. The pickets are at the main gates on the opposite side of the compound. They haven't posted anyone on the rear side. Once we are clear of the lane, it is a straight run out onto the main road to Windhoek. We'll be clear in a matter of seconds." "Not we, Dr. Twentyman Jones," she said, and he stared at her. "You don't intend going alone?" he asked. "I have just made the journey alone, swiftly and with not the least sign of trouble. I anticipate no problem with the return. I need you here. You know I cannot leave the mine to Brantingham or one of the clerks. You have to be here to deal with these strikers. Without you, they may wreck the plant or sabotage the workings. It would only take a stick or two of dynamite." He wiped his face with his open hand from forehead to chin, in an agony of indecision, torn between two duties. The mine, which he had built up from nothing, and which was his pride, and the woman whom he loved as dearly as a daughter or a wife he had never had. At last he sighed. She was right. It had to be that way. "Then take one of the men with you," he pleaded. "Brantingham, bless him?" she asked, raising her eyebrows. And he threw up both hands as he saw how ridiculous that idea was. "I'll take the Daimler round to the back," he said. "Then I'll get a telegraph through to AB in Windhoek. He can send out an escort immediately to meet you on the road. That is, if the strikers haven't cut the wires yet." "Don't send that until I am clear," Santane instructed. "The strikers may just have had enough sense to have a tap put on the line. In fact, that is probably why they have not cut it yet." Twentyman Jones nodded. "Very well. What time do you intend breaking out?" 3 o'clock tomorrow morning," she said, without hesitation. It was the hour when human vitality was at its lowest ebb. That was when the strike picket would be least prepared for swift reaction. "Very well, Mrs. Courtney. I will have my cook prepare you a light dinner, and then I suggest you get some rest. I will have everything ready and wake you at 2:30. She woke the instant he touched her shoulder and sat up. 2:30, Twentyman Jones said. "The Daimler is refueled and the diamonds loaded. The barbed wire is cut. I have drawn you a bath, and there is a selection of fresh clothes from the bungalow." "I will be ready in 15 minutes, she said. They stood beside the Daimler in the darkened garage and spoke in whispers. The double doors were open, and there was a crescent moon lighting the yard. "I have marked the gap in the wire," Twentyman Jones pointed, and she saw the small white flags drooping from the barbed wire strands 50 yards away. "The canisters of industrial diamonds are in the boot, but I have put the package of top stones on the passenger seat beside you." He leaned through the open window and patted the black dispatch box. It was the size and shape of a small suitcase, but of Japan steel with a brass lock. "Good." Santaine buttoned her dust jacket and pulled on her soft dogskin driving gauntlets. "The shotgun is loaded with number 10 birdshot, so you can fire at anybody who tries to stop you without risk of committing murder. It'll just give them a good sting. But if you mean business, there is a box of buckshot in the glove compartment." Santaine slid in behind the wheel and pulled the door closed gently, so as not to alert a listener out in the silent night. She placed the double-barrel shotgun on top of the diamond chest and cocked both hammers. "There is a basket in the boot, sandwiches and a thermos of coffee." She looked at him out of the side window and said seriously, "You are my tower." "Don't let anything happen to you," he said. "A pox on the diamonds, we can dig more of them. You are unique. There's only one of you." Impulsively, he unbuckled the service revolver from around his waist and leaned into the Daimler to push it into the pocket at the back of the driver's seat. "It's the only insurance I can offer you. Remember, there is a cartridge under the hammer," he said. "Pray you never need it." He stepped back and gave her a laconic salute. "Godspeed." She started the Daimler, and the great 7-litre engine rumbled softly. She flipped off the handbrake, switched on the headlights, and gunned the Daimler out through the open doors and across the yard, going up through the gears in a deft series of racing changes. She aimed the mascot on the bonnet between the white markers, roared through the gap in the fence at 40 miles an hour, and felt a loose strand of barbed wire scrape down the side of the coachwork. Then she tramped down on the brake and spun the wheel, steering the front wheels onto the dusty lane, meeting the skid and then going flat on the accelerator pedal again. She shot down the lane, with the Daimler roaring at full power. Above the engine she heard faint shouts and saw the dark, indistinct figures of a mob of strikers racing down the fence from the main gate to try and intercept her at the corner of the lane. She picked up the shotgun and thrust the double muzzles through the window beside her. In the headlights, the faces of the running men were ugly with rage, their mouths dark pits as they shouted at her. Two of them were swifter than their mates, and they reached the corner of the lane just as the Daimler came level. One of the strikers flung his pick handle, and it cartwheeled through the beam of the headlights and clanged off the bonnet. Santaine depressed the shotgun, aiming for their legs, and fired both barrels, with long spurts of orange flame and blurts of sound. Birdshot lashed their legs, and the strikers howled with shock and pain and leapt off the road as Santaine roared past them and turned onto the main road down the slope and out into the desert. "Four pettifogger, urgent and imperative, Juno, unaccompanied, departed this end 3 a.m. instant carrying goods. Stop. Immediately dispatch armed escort to intercept her en route. Ends Vant." Lothar de la Rey stared at the message he had copied under his pad by the guttering flame of the candle. "Unaccompanied," he whispered. "Juno unaccompanied. Carrying goods. By Christ Almighty, she's coming through alone. With the diamonds." He calculated swiftly. "She left the mine at 3 a.m. She'll be here an hour or so after noon." He left the dugout and climbed the bank. He found a place to sit and lit one of his precious cheroots. He looked at the sky, watching the crescent moon sink into the desert. When the dawn turned the eastern horizon into a peacock's tail of colour, he went down to the camp and blew flame from last night's ashes. Svart Hendrik came out of the dugout and went to urinate noisily in the sand. He came back to the fire, buttoning his breeches, yawning widely, and sniffing the coffee in the billy. "We are changing the plan," Lothar told him, and Hendrik blinked and became warily attentive. "Why?" "The woman is bringing the diamonds through alone. She won't give in easily. I don't want to hurt her in any way."
"I wouldn't."
"The hell you wouldn't. When you get excited, you shoot." Lothar cut him off brusquely. "But that's not the only reason." He ticked off the others on his fingers. "First, one woman alone requires only one man. I have time enough to re-rig the ropes to bring down the boulders into the cutting from my position. Two, the woman knows you. It doubles the risk of having us recognized. Three," he paused. The true reason was that he wanted to be alone with Santaine again. It would be the last time. He would never be coming back this way again. "Lastly," he said, "we will do it this way because I say we will. You will stay here with Manfred and the horses, ready to ride as soon as I've done the job." Hendrik shrugged.
"I will help you rig the ropes," he grunted.
Santaine stopped the Daimler at the head of the cutting and left the engine running as she jumped out onto the running board and surveyed the crossing. Her own outward tracks were still as clear and sharp and untouched in the soft lemon-coloured dust. There had been no other traffic through the drift since she had passed the night before last. She unhooked the water bag and drank three mouthfuls, and then corked it again and hung it on the spare wheel bracket, climbed back into the cab, slammed the door, and let off the handbrake. She let the Daimler trundle down the incline, swiftly gathering speed, when suddenly there was a rush of earth and rock. A swirling cloud of dust obscured the cutting directly ahead of her, and she hit the brake hard. The bank had collapsed on one side and had almost filled the cutting with rock and loose earth.
"Merde!"
she swore. It would mean a delay while she cleared the rubble or found another place to cross. She snapped the Daimler into reverse and twisted in her seat, looking back through the missing rear window that the striker had knocked out, preparing to back up the incline. And she felt the first flutter of alarm against her ribs. The bank had collapsed behind the Daimler also, sliding down in a soft, churned ramp. She was trapped in the cutting. And she leaned out of the open window and looked about her anxiously, coughing in the dust that still billowed around her vehicle. As it cleared, she saw that the road ahead was only partially blocked. On the opposite side to the landslide, there was still a narrow gap. Not sufficient for the wide track of the Daimler to get through, but there was a spade strapped to the roof rack. A few hours' work in the burning sun should clear the way enough for her to work the Daimler through. But the setback galled her. She reached for the door handle, and then a premonition of danger stopped her hand, and she looked up the bank beside her. There was a man standing at the top of the rise, looking down at her. His boots, at the level of her eyes, were scuffed and white with dust. There were dark sweat patches on his blue shirt. He was a tall man, but he had the lean, hard look of a soldier or a hunter. However, it was the rifle that he carried across his hip, pointing down into her face, and the mask he wore that terrified her. The mask was a white flower bag. She could read the red and blue lettering on it, Premier Milling Company Limited. An innocuous kitchen article, endowed with infinite menace by the two eye holes that had been cut into the cloth. The mask and the rifle told her exactly what to expect. A whole series of thoughts flashed through her mind as she sat frozen at the wheel, staring up at him. The diamonds are not insured. That was the thought at the forefront of her mind. The next staging post is 40 miles ahead, was the next thought, and then I forgot to reload the shotgun. Spent shells in both barrels. The man above her spoke, his voice muffled by the mask and obviously disguised. Switch off the engine. He gestured with the rifle to enforce the order. Get out. She got out and looked around her desperately. Her terror gone now, burned away by the need to think and act. Her eyes fastened directly ahead on the narrow gap left between the soft ramp of raw earth, where the landslide had poured down in front of her, and the steep, firm bank on the other side. I can get through, she thought, or at least I can try. And she ducked back into the cab. Stop! The man above her yelled, but she slammed the Daimler into low gear. The rear wheels spun in the fine yellow dust, throwing it back in twin fountains. The Daimler lurched forward, the tail swaying and skidding, but it gathered speed sharply, and Santayne aimed the bonnet at the narrow gap between the bank and the slide of earth and rock. She heard the man above her shout again, and then a warning rifle shot cracked over the top of the cab, but she ignored it and concentrated on taking the Daimler out of the trap. She rode her off side wheels high up the incline of the bank, and the Daimler reared over on its side almost to the point of capsizing. But its speed was still building up. Santayne was heavily shaken and tossed about, so that she had only her grip on the steering wheel to keep her in her seat, as the big car canted even further over. Still the gap was too narrow. Her near side wheels smashed into the piled earth and rock. The Daimler bucked wildly, throwing its nose high, flying up and forward like a hunter at a fence. Santayne was hurled towards the windshield, but she flung up a hand to brace herself and clung to the wheel with the other. The Daimler came down again with a rending crash, jerking Santayne back against the padded leather seat. She felt unyielding rock slam up into the Daimler's belly, like a boxer taking a heavy body blow. And the back wheels crabbed over the pile of broken earth, the rubber tires screeching as they sought purchase on the tumbled boulders. Then they caught and flung the Daimler forward again. It dropped down the far side of the obstacle and hit hard. Santayne heard something break, the clanging rupture of one of the steering rods, and the wheels spun without resistance in her hands. The Daimler had fought its way over the barrier, but it was mortally wounded and out of control. The steering gone, and the throttle linkage jammed wide open. Santayne screamed and clung to the walnut dashboard as it roared down the cutting towards the riverbed, slamming into one bank and then hurling across and crashing into the other, the coachwork banging and ripping and buckling at each impact. She tried desperately to reach the ignition switch, but the speedometer needle was flicking at the 30-mile-per-hour notch, and she was thrown across the passenger seat. The steel corner of the diamond case gouged her ribs, and she was thrown back the other way. The door beside her burst open just as the Daimler roared out of the cutting into the riverbed, and Santayne was hurled out through it. Instinctively, she doubled herself into a ball, as though she were taking a fall from a galloping horse. And she rolled in the soft white sand, head over heels, coming up at last on her knees. The Daimler was slewing wildly across the riverbed, the engine still roaring, and one of the front wheels, damaged by the rocks of the barrier, flew off, bounding and leaping like a wild creature until it struck the far bank. The front end of the Daimler dropped, and the nose dug into the sand. The engine was still roaring, and the huge vehicle somersaulted end over end and came down on its back. The three remaining wheels pointed at the sky, spinning in a blur, the glass in the windows crackling and splintering into diamond chips, the cab buckling and sagging, hot oil pouring out of the slats in the bonnet and soaking into the sand. Santaine pushed herself up and was running as she regained her feet. The sand clung to her ankles. It was like running in a bath of treacle, and terror had heightened her senses so that time seemed to stand still. It was like one of those terrible dreams in which all her movements were reduced to slow motion. She dared not look behind her. That menacing, masked figure must surely be close. She tensed for the grip of the hand that would seize her at any instant, or the slam of a bullet into her back. But she reached the Daimler and dropped on her knees in the sand beside it. The driver's door had been torn off, and she crawled halfway into the aperture. The shotgun was wedged against the steering control, but she dragged it clear and ripped open the small door of the glove compartment. The cardboard box of shotgun shells was scarlet with black lettering, Ely Kynoch, 12-gauge, 25 SSG. It broke open under her frantic fingers, and the red brass-tipped shells spilled into the sand around her knees. She pushed across the breech lock of the shotgun with her thumb and broke open the gun. The two empty birdshot cartridges flew out with a crisp click-click of the ejectors, and the gun was snatched out of her hands. The masked man stood over her. He must have moved like a hunting leopard to come down the bank and across the riverbed so quickly. He flung the empty shotgun out across the sand. It landed 50 feet away, but the impetus of the throw had swung him off balance. Santaine launched herself at him, coming off her knees and driving her whole weight into his chest, just below the raised left arm that he had used to throw the shotgun. It was unexpected, and he was balanced on one foot. They went over together in the sand. For an instant, Santaine was on top of him, and then she wriggled away, came to her feet, and floundered back towards the Daimler. The engine was still racing, blue smoke pouring from the engine as the oil drained away from the sump, and it overheated. The pistol! Santaine seized the handle of the rear door and threw her weight against it. Through the window she could see the leather holster and the checkered butt of Twentyman Jones's service revolver protruding from the seat pocket. But the door was jammed. She ducked back to the gaping front door and tried to reach it over the back of the driver's seat. But bone-hard fingers dug into her shoulders, and she was dragged bodily out of the doorway. Instantly she spun in his grip, and his face was very close to hers. The thin white cotton bag covered his entire head, like the head of a Ku Klux Klansman. The eye holes were dark as the hollow sockets in a skull, but there was a glint of human eyes deep in the shadow, and she went for them with her fingernails. He jerked his head away, but her forefinger hooked in the thin cloth and ripped it down to his chin. He seized her wrists, and instead of pulling away, she hurled herself against him and drove her right knee up into his groin. He twisted violently and caught her knee on the side of his upper thigh. She felt the shock of the blow drive into the rubbery muscle of his leg, but his grip on her wrists tightened as though she had been caught in the jaws of a steel gin trap. She ducked her head and fastened her teeth into his wrist like a ferret, at the same time kicking and kneeing him in the lower body and shins, raining blows at him, most of them slogging into his hard flesh or bouncing off bone. He was grunting and trying to control her. Obviously he hadn't expected this type of wild resistance, and the pain in his wrist must have been excruciating. Already the hinges of her jaws were cramping with the force of her bite. She could feel tissue and flesh splitting and tearing between her teeth, and his blood welled into her mouth, hot and coppery and salt-tasting. With his free hand, the masked man seized a handful of her thick, curly hair and tried to pull her head back. She was breathing through her nose, snuffling like a bulldog, and gritting her teeth in with all her strength, and she reached the bone. It grated under her teeth, and the man was tugging and jerking at her head, giving small, agonized cries and grunts. She closed her eyes, expecting him at any moment to slam his fist into the side of her head and break the grip of her teeth. But he was strangely gentle and considerate in his reaction, not attempting to inflict injury or pain, merely trying to pull her off. She felt something burst in her mouth. She had bitten through an artery in his wrist. Blood pumped against the roof of her palate with hot spurts that threatened to choke and drown her. She let it pour from the corners of her mouth without relaxing her bite. It sprayed from her lips and spattered them both as he jerked her head from side to side. He was moaning with agony now, and at last he used punitive force. He dug thumb and forefinger into the hinges of her jaw. His fingers were like iron spikes. Pain shot down into her locked jaws and up behind her eyes, and she opened her mouth and flung herself backwards, again taking him by surprise, breaking out of his grip and darting away back towards the Daimler. This time, she thrust her arm over the back of the driver's seat and reached up to the butt of the revolver. It slipped from the greased holster, and while she fumbled with a shaking hand to get a hold on it, the masked man seized her hair from behind and jerked her backwards. The heavy pistol fell through her fingers and clattered against the steel of the inverted cab. She rounded on him again, snapping at his face with teeth that were still stained pink with his blood. The torn mask flapped over his face, blinding him for an instant, and he stumbled and fell, holding her in his arms. She was kicking and scratching and slashing at him as he rolled on top of her and pinned her with his full weight, holding her arms spread like a crucifix. And suddenly she stopped struggling and stared up at him. The flap of his mask hung open, and she could see his eyes. Those strange, pale, topaz-coloured eyes with the long, dark lashes. And she gasped. Lothar!